In a previous episode, I have mentioned a thing called Savannah, which is a community relationship management program thing that a friend of the show, Michael Hall, created over a period of years, and it's written in Django. And I was using it for a while, and I am no longer using it because I've written my own thing. And my own thing is called Canopy. Huh. And I'd like to introduce you to Canopy.
Now, was it easier to write your own thing than it was to uplift the underpinnings of Savannah? Because I think the last time we talked about Savannah, you were juggling how to move through multiple versions of past Django and SQL schema uplift and stuff.
In answer to your question, yes, I think starting from scratch was the right idea for my head, because there was some craft and legacy stuff in Savannah, and it's Django, which means a certain version of Django, a certain version of Python, and so there's a whole bunch of Python libraries, and keeping on top of all of that was actually pretty painful. I went through a bit of work to uplift Savannah to a newer version of everything, basically. Mm-hmm. And I got it working for the most part. But then I thought, actually maintaining this thing on the newer version is not a pleasurable experience for me, because not only am I maintaining somebody else's legacy code base, there's also the front end UI, which is something I wasn't super familiar with. And Django, I'm not an especially big fan of. And I'd done some other things in the interim, not in Python. And I felt like I would like to do something else, not in Python. Okay. And so part of it was, I don't want to do this in Python. And part of it was, I don't want to do this with Django. And part of it was legacy code, somebody else's code. And part of it was just a bit of a challenge to see if I could do it.
Okay, so parts of that sound a bit like a throwback to an old episode where you talked about the joy of coding. You've just found the joy of coding through other things other than Python and PHP these days, it seems.
Yes, and in that episode where I talked about the joy of coding, I talked about not sharing what I'm coding. Right. And I've fallen into the trap of sharing it, as in it exists as a hosted application that people can sign into, a selected group of my friends can sign into and give me feedback and tell me if this is the right thing that I'm doing or if it's working for them or not. And that's led to some encouragement from those people telling me, you should really like make this public. Mm-hmm. Because it's not currently open source. Part of that whole joy of coding episode was I would not make things open source necessarily straight away because of that fear of like everyone looking at it, scrutinizing it, and also the pressure that I'd have to maintain it. Well, now I've put the pressure on myself to maintain this thing, and now I think actually it's probably a good time to think about open sourcing it.
So if it's not Python, what did you choose?
So I went with Go for the back end, because there's quite a good set of libraries for what I want to do. And I've used TypeScript for the front end, and it looks a bit more modern than Savannah mm-hmm. did. I'm not throwing shade at Michael or Savannah, because there's a lot of inspiration that Canopy has from Savannah, and the UI is very similar because there are a lot of things in Savannah that worked and mm-hmm. worked quite well. So for those who haven't listened to that episode, mm-hmm. I haven't actually described what it does. A community relationship manager application. It's like a CRM system, but all about community. And so if you work in open sourcey stuff, it's common for a community manager or developer relations person to want to have an understanding about how the community is working, meaning when are new people arriving? Who's contributing the most? Who's interacting with who in that, you know, who is supporting other people? Who can you reward for being a good advocate for the thing that you're supporting? And who are contributing the most? Maybe you want to send them a t-shirt or just send them a thank you, or who's having problems and may need some help. You know, there's a lot of things in a community to measure. And often open source communities have a very small team of people who are able to have visibility across everything, mm-hmm. especially if the community is spread across a number of platforms. So it could be that the main development happens on somewhere like GitHub, but not necessarily GitHub. It could be that conversation happens on Discourse or Discord or Matrix or Mastodon, like who knows? And so you can end up with these little silos of like semi-communities or demi-communities within your open source project. And it's sometimes hard, especially for a small community or a small team, to kind of have a handle on what's going on. And if they lose track, then maybe they'll lose a contributor who feels that their voice isn't being heard, or maybe someone does a pull request and nobody reviews it, or people file issues and nobody's looking at them. But yeah, there's a number of reasons that open source things can go wrong. And so the goal of Canopy is to enable people to have what they call a single pane of glass, like a dashboard that shows what's going on in your community. That's the goal of it. And that's what it does.
I suppose in this day and age, one of the indicators that you'd be interested in is seeing somebody who was very active, who's dropped off, and maybe being able to stop people that are trying to coerce their way into positions of responsibility. You know, the whole supply chain attack thing is, you know, very much contemporary right now.
Yeah, there's certainly some of that. I know that's a kind of, that's a thing some people in security world are, you know, worried about. But I think the thing that a lot of people really care about is just the onboarding experience. Like someone arrives in your community and they say hello and they introduce themselves, or they file their very first issue, and then they get loads of replies from some various people who are much more knowledgeable and they don't know what to do. Now, some of that you can deal with code of conduct or, you know, keeping on top of those people. But with a large project, it can be difficult keeping on top of those things. And so having a tool that gives you sight of this person has just joined, this person has filed their first issue, or this person has started their first conversation, or this person has attended their first event, you know, welcome this person and signpost the things, the documentation they might need, or the contributor guidelines and stuff like that. It's that kind of thing. It's the idea is to create a tool that allows community managers and developer advocates and developer relations people to be able to have sight of what's going on, so they can have a better understanding of the human side of things, the people who are part of their community.
And is the idea that it would like prompt you to say, oh, you know, here's this person that's just had their first issue merged, go and congratulate them? Or is it just at the moment you've got the numbers and you can work out what you want to do with that yourself?
Ideally, you're both, because some people will want to be super proactive, or reactive, I guess it is, when they see someone do their first pull request, go and jump on their issue and thumbs up it and thanks very much and be really effusive. Not everyone likes that. Not everyone likes receiving that. And so it's very different depending on the culture and the locale and the type of people you are. So I think having the numbers is one thing, being able to tell that person is new, they've done a new thing. You can decide what to do with that information. And so, yes, maybe there is a notification system in there that tells you this person has done a new contribution, and it does highlight new contributors, but also it will tell you if someone hasn't contributed for a while. Now, that may not be a bad thing. They might be on vacation, or they might be on sabbatical, or they might just be busy with life, right? But if there was someone who was a really significant contributor to the project, and then you take your eye off the ball because you may have life things going on, and then you see a notification that says so-and-so hasn't contributed for a while, that might remind you to just check in with them. Maybe they're fine and they're just outside touching grass, but also maybe they're having a bad day, and maybe they'd appreciate someone who they recognize from a project they care about reaching out to them and saying hello and just checking in with them. It can be as simple as that, that makes them think, oh yeah, I remember that. I was really keen on contributing to that thing. And now you've reached out and said, hello, I'll come back. Or it might be just an opportunity for them to say, actually, I'm a bit burned out and I don't want to do this anymore. And that's fine. That's an equally acceptable thing to do in the open source community. But having the ability for a community manager to know that that's happening is important, I think, for some communities.
Yeah, and there's the inverse of that as well, because that's a little bit sort of sad. The upside of it is that if you've got a growing community and, you know, the one or two people that maybe started a project have got more going on than they can cope with, tools like this can help you identify those people that are particularly passionate, not just about the project, but maybe niches within the project. So if you know you need somebody to keep an eye on documentation contributions, or maybe the lead the translation effort or whatever it might be, it can help identify those people that are particularly active in particular areas to sort of spread the project responsibility.
Yeah, it also highlights things like, if you've got too few people responsible for too much of the contribution. So if it's like two people are responsible for more than 50% of all the pull requests in this project, maybe that's not sustainable, because if one of them burns out or one of them decides to have a kid or whatever, then that could put your project in jeopardy. Mm-hmm. And similarly, if your project has a lot of commercial sponsors or employees of commercial entities, and you're dependent upon just one commercial entity for all of your contributors, and they decide to use another tool and you no longer have any contributors, that's a worry. And so you might not even know that. You might not even know that half of your contributors come from one company, or, you know, one or two companies. And so surfacing that kind of information, it's a bit boring and it's a bit businessy, but reporting on this kind of stuff is kind of important, because you never know when those people are just going to walk away and you don't know why. And maybe having some inkling ahead of time that maybe you got too many eggs in one basket and too many contributors from one organization, or too many contributions from one person. I don't mean too many. I mean, an outsized proportion of the contributions from one person might put your project at jeopardy if they leave.
So that's the bit that I'm interested in. You've mentioned that, you know, it can report on these things. I imagine there's all sorts of charts and graphs to support that. But is there like a super secret hidden one that the sort of the project owners can look at to tell them you are in jeopardy because you are overburdened, and, you know, your community health report says you need to spread the load a little bit. You're taking on too much here.
It's not super secret. It's right there in the front page on the dashboard. It's like the second thing you see. It says like it's at risk. Now, these numbers are all a little bit tweakable, and I'm not the first person to write a tool that does this. There's a whole bunch of these. There's one called Common Room that was recently bought by Zoom. The Linux Foundation have a tool called Insights. There was one called Orbit, which no longer exists. I don't know where that went. And so there are a few of these community tools, and I've tried to make it as featureful as I can, and I've added plugins so it can connect to GitHub, Discord, Discourse for communication, Matrix, Mastodon, Luma for events, and it's got an API that you could just inject data in as well. And I've had a bunch of people testing it across a whole bunch of communities, and the general feedback has been quite good. And I've had also feedback telling me, you know, it'd be good if it did this thing or that thing. And I'm, yeah, over the weekends when everyone's out or asleep, I'll sit there while I've got a film on in the background, I'll sit and hack away at it. And it's come along a long way. And I'm absolutely petrified of making it open source because of, you know, see previous episode about the joy of code.
Well, I've got a couple of questions about that. The first thing is, at the beginning you mentioned that you'd chosen to implement it in Go for the back end and TypeScript for the front end. Well, I've got news for you, Alan. That makes you a full stack developer, by the way.
Also, it's deployed in Docker.
Oh my goodness. I mean, I know, right? We really are a full stack developer.
Yeah.
I'm so surprised by that. I've forgotten what my second point is.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I've been working on this for like a year, And it's accelerated a bit in the last 6 months because where I work needed something that did this.
Right.
And so that inspired me to like accelerate things a little bit. I would like to make this available, but mm-hmm. I think I need to do a few more security audits and some checking of a few things before I just like open it up, because I'm paranoid about people.
Okay,
like,
so
finding holes.
I remembered my question. I think you've half answered it there, which is like, what is it that you're sort of worried about making it open source?
It really comes down to people just looking at it and going, that's terrible. That's it. That's all it takes is for someone to just like critique it and just say, this is awful. And that'll be it. I'll be upset.
in your new position as full stack developer, I think you'll find there'll be very few people actually looking at the code, and they'll be more interested in the functionality and utility of the software and how it looks and works rather than, you know, the code under the hood. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. I've shipped some shocking code over the years. Nobody noticed.
So what I would say is, if anyone wants to have a play with it, I am going to open source it, but if anyone wants to play with it and they have, this sounds like something that might be interesting to them, if they've got an open source community that's got code on GitHub and conversations happening somewhere, let me know and I'll set it up for them and they can have a play with it and then they can give me some feedback. And if there's features I'm missing or things that don't work, then they can let me know, and that will help me to have a very successful launch, whenever that is, which will probably be quite soon.
Mm, and an even more successful IPO. I have started talking to my computers, and I think this is the biggest productivity upgrade I've experienced with using computers for a very long time.
I've been to Martin's office, and every so often I'll hear him mumbling away and I'll think, I think he's talking to me, and he's not. He's talking to his computer.
Oh, okay. So you actually do this in an office where other people are around. I mean, I can imagine doing it at home when everyone else isn't there, but mm-hmm. I would be extremely self-conscious with other humans being able to see me and hear me doing it.
Okay. Let's get this part of the conversation out of the way early on. There is no amount of feeling like a plum talking to your computer that degrades over time. It only builds. It gets worse. I feel self-conscious when I'm in a closed room all by myself. But when I'm in the office, my rented space, some of the people around me have not been particularly subtle in the way they've come up to my glass door and pulled the door shut as I'm chatting to my computer. And I'll have you know, I find their stand-ups at the 9:10 every morning on their excruciatingly loud loudspeaker to be far more obnoxious than me uttering to my computer. So there's that, which does make me feel extremely self-conscious. And then even at home, I'll be in the office here and I'll be saying things to the computer, and then I get concerned, you know, wives and daughters turning up at the door looking at me sort of, you know, are you okay? Are you talking to us? Oh, you're talking to your computer again. Is it time for us to have you committed? So there is a definite self-consciousness to this whole proceeding. It's not good, but it's a glorious bit of technology and I think everyone should give it a try. And I got the idea from two places. First of all, a friend of ours, Will Cook, who suggested not just trying this, but he suggested the software that I'm using. But the thing that really pushed me over the line was when we were at the Ubuntu Summit, they talked about an initiative that's happening within Ubuntu that for 26.10, which is coming up in October this year, the desktop team are integrating voice input as a standard feature across the entire desktop. And they talked, and I think that was the first outing of that information. So we got not an early look at the technology, but what they were planning to do. And it just got me thinking, like, it's like, yeah, I should probably have a look at that, not least because it's interesting, but also I've mentioned before, I've got, you know, one hand which is really quite badly damaged, so typing's not great. So I thought I'd take a look. And then not so long ago, I talked about the new computers that I've got, and I've got some NPUs and GPUs, and I've been looking for a way to take advantage of that hardware. So I thought I'll try and combine all of this and have a go. And so following on from Will's advice, I have set up a bit of software called VoxType, which is simply advertised as voice to text for Linux and Mac OS. And yes, it's open source, it's on GitHub, there'll be a link to the show, and it has packages available for all of the distributions in all of the places in all of the formats you will expect to find it.
So what can you actually use it for?
Well, it turns out just about everything. So first of all, I suppose we should think about where you can use it, because I've got these new beefy workstations with lots of AI acceleration stuff, but it supports a number of different local AI models that are specifically tuned for doing voice to text.
Right.
And it supports models that will just work on the CPU all the way through to progressively larger models that work on the GPU and use increasing amounts of video memory. And part of the model selection is some of the models are tuned for sort of European languages, some of the models are tuned for Asian languages. And so some of the model selection comes about like what language you're going to be principally using as to which would be the best for detecting. So all of that's documented. It's not difficult. You just choose one that is suitable for your language and matches the sort of features of the hardware that you have available. And I think the next thing to say about that is it really doesn't matter which model you choose, whether it's running on the CPU or the GPU. These voice-to-text models, even on a CPU, are very fast and very accurate, at least in my experience of using them. I've been very impressed with that.
You've just switched on a light for me. I've realized I work in an open plan office 3 days a week in London, and someone who sits near me is a big fan of these speech-to-text things. He uses it a lot to talk to his computer. And I've just realized I keep thinking that he is the busiest man in the office because he's always in one of the little silent pods,
right,
always having meetings. And I now realize he's not having meetings at all.
Yeah,
he's going into one of these silent pods so that nobody gets irritated by him speaking in his delightful French accent.
Right.
But nobody gets irritated by him like speaking loudly in an open space.
Yeah.
And he spends a lot of time in that room and he uses it a lot, like probably more than you do. And it didn't like click until you like said just how useful it is and how much you use it. And now I'm going to relentlessly open the door while he's having conversations.
Yeah, I mean, I think all credit to them for finding a private space to do this, because as I said, I can't understate just how awkward you feel, even if you're in a completely private environment. Talking to your computer does feel weird. It is weird. I'm not going to say otherwise.
Have you ever wondered if you might be talking to your computer and it converting your speech to text and someone reading that and then talking to their computer and it converting their speech to text, and you could actually be having a conversation by voice instead?
No, that hasn't occurred to me.
It's asynchronous though. I mean, what you're then talking about, Mark, is voice notes.
Oh yeah.
Careful what you wish for.
Yeah, so I suppose this isn't about having a voice conversation with the computer. This is about replacing the keyboard as a means of text entry. So
right,
instead of typing on the keyboard, I just say words into a microphone and the words that I've said appear in whatever the application is. And that's, I think you started with, is where does this work? Well, everywhere that you can place the cursor and text is the input mechanism, it works. It works in the terminal, it works in Telegram clients, word processors. And the reason I started doing this is because I thought it would be a way to accelerate my typing into a sort of AI-assisted coding tools to give them the guidance and instructions that I wanted.
So it's not like a full voice interface to your computer. It's more like a dictation tool. You don't say, you know, open Firefox, highlight address bar, go to this URL. You just click in the address bar and you say, go to example.com. No, you don't say go to example.com. You say example.com and then you press enter.
Exactly that. Yes, exactly that. So you just put the cursor and instead of touching the keyboard, you say words into the microphone. And whilst you're talking, it displays an OSD on the screen. So when it's activated, you don't. There isn't a watchword that it listens for. There is a key. You choose what the key binding is. You push that key. The overlay appears and you talk. And you can either push to talk or you can toggle on and off. And when it's detected you've finished talking, it turns what you said into words. And that's the interesting thing about this, because it transcribes what you meant to say, not what you said. And this is very clever. And actually, the thing that kind of blew me away and changed the way that I use this tool. So when you're talking and you and ah, or you have lots of pregnant pauses, or maybe you trip over your words and you say, what did I say earlier? Botcast in the pre-show. It will pick up all of that and it edits that out. So the text that it produces at the end of this is free from all of the ums and ahs and stumbles and is just the corrected text. It's amazing.
We should do it. We should get it to edit this podcast. Is what everyone was thinking, I think.
How does it handle, if you think of it as a dictation tool, how does it handle like things like punctuation or special characters? Can you dictate code with it?
I haven't tried dictating code at all. It has never occurred to me to try that. But it will, from the cadence of your speech, choose the correct punctuation. But if you want to be specific, you can say full stop, comma, semicolon, colon, or whatever, and it will put those characters into the text that it produces.
Right. I think you just said a fork bomb there, Martin. Careful.
Maybe I did. So after having used this for a bit, I think it binds to the scroll lock key by default, which is fine on like a full desktop computer, but not so handy on like a miniaturized laptop. So I'd bound it to Super V on my laptops for voice. But I thought, you know what I want? I want its own special button, its own button that is, this is the button I push when I want to talk. So I went on to, was it Etsy, I think, or maybe it was AliExpress. Anyway, I bought myself a single button keyboard, single keyboard button on a USB thing for like £2. And it plugs in over USB. And when you plug it in and you push the thing, it spits out an enter. And that was very disappointing because that's not what that's not the button you want. And the software that's available for these things is only available for Windows. And a lot of these little buttons are so cheap they don't even ship with the software. So you don't know which software you need. But I found a remarkable piece of software called KeyD, which is a key remapping daemon for Linux, and it could not be simpler. The configuration basically is the vendor ID and device ID of the USB device, and then the evdev key code for what input is coming in and what it should send out instead. So I just have this entry, which is vendor device and enter, and then I have put out the pause break button on my main keyboard as the one that it sends. But it could be F24, for example, which is one of these F keys that you just don't get bound to keyboards. And so KeyD's great.
Can I describe to our dear listener where this button is located? if you imagine, if you're sat at a desk right now listening to us, look down, turn your head to the left and look at the leg of the table that's to your left. And it, at the top of that leg, imagine a white doorbell button about there.
Like a panic button.
Yes, very much like a panic button, like someone pressing it rapidly as Alan comes towards them. Like, that is exactly what it's like. And when he first installed it, and I went in the office, he went, "Here, look at this." And they just like put his index finger and just went, pressed it, and then said something, and this waveform appears on the screen. I was like, "Oh, yeah, very clever." It actually is quite impressive how accurate it is and how useful it is that, like, as Martin said, you could be in any window. So long as it's an input field, you just pull out your big digit, press the button,
yeah,
and chatter away to it. And yeah, it works. It's really good. I was quite impressed with that.
Yes, it is very good. And as I had envisaged that I would be using this for telling AI agents what to do, which I do use it for, the killer feature is replying to Slack messages. It is so good to just see a Slack message and you need to reply to it. You push the button, you say a few words, a short sentence comes out, it's edited, spell corrected, and it's done. It is the best way to interact with Slack ever. I love it.
I have been continuing my antifungal adventure playing The Last of Us Part 2. And this time, it has roguelike elements.
Oh, now we're whistling.
Is this a completely different game, or is it just DLC for the first one?
This is the sequel. So the previous game was Part 1, and this is the sequel,
yeah, I got
which
that.
Is called Part 2.
Right.
I think one of the things you said when you played Part 1 is it was like a remaster or a re-release on PC sometime after a console version. So what's sort of the era of this game, and was this a PC release from the beginning?
So I think this originally came out on the PS4, and then this is the remaster, which was released on the PS5 and PC.
Right.
So it's, I think it came out maybe last year or the year before, but not, it wasn't actually that long after the original that they did the remaster as the sort of follow-up to the remaster of the original.
Right.
I mean, as a game, it's very familiar. If you've played the first one, it's more of the same, essentially. You're going around post-apocalyptic America, avoiding zombies, getting in gunfights, sneaking around, making bombs and throwing them at each other. Much bigger game. Probably takes about twice as long to get through the main story as it did on the first game. And that's because there's more characters, there's sort of parallel storylines that are interwoven. Again, a lot of narrative, just like the first game. It sort of switches things up a bit in quite a good way. In the first game, there were basically only three types of zombies and then guys with guns were your other enemy. They've added different kinds of zombies that behave differently and are a bit trickier to deal with. And they've introduced different factions of people who behave in different ways and fight with different weapons, and you have to deal with them differently. So it's added a nice bit of variety and a nice sort of follow-on story from the original.
Does this follow the TV show or not? It's the other way around, isn't it? The TV show follows this.
The TV show was based on this. I don't know how closely the plot of the TV show follows the plot of this game or not, because I've not watched it. But now I've finished this game, I might seek it out. but yeah, essentially you've got two separate characters who you follow through parallel events. At first you play as one, and then you get to a point, and then you go back and play through as the other, and then you sort of finish. But there's also a sort of recut version that you can play. It doesn't recommend you do this until after you know the story, but you can actually play it through chronologically, because there's a lot of sort of time jumps and going back into memories, and then you've got the two characters playing like through the same days but doing different things. So if you're sort of confused by that, you can go back and see how it all happened in order.
So when you say you play as two characters and you play the same timeline one back to back, are you playing like the same route through the game, or are you just playing from a a different character in the same timeline, but from completely different points in the world.
It's mostly different. You do get some crossover where you notice you're sort of you're going through an environment, and then something happens, and you're like, "Oh, that's why that was there." When you saw it as the other character before, or you might bump into a character from the other timeline that you've played, and there's sort of other crossovers there, but mostly they're sort of separate but parallel,
right?
Until they meet up at the end.
So you're not like switching between the characters, you're playing the game effectively twice, but from different perspectives.
Exactly, yeah. It's not like in the first game you had two characters, but they were together, and you'd sometimes play a bit as one, right, and then a bit as the other, but they would be going through together, whereas these are two characters with different stories playing alongside one another.
And this is the same characters as in the first one?
No, one of them is.
Right.
And the other one isn't. And any more information than that would be a massive spoiler.
Okay, fair enough.
I think you've already done that. But yes, are there any cannibals in this series?
Cannibals? No, cannibals were in the previous one.
Oh, okay.
And there's a mention, there's a lot of sort of callbacks to things that happened in the previous game as well. Like,
right.
Stuff like that, like the characters talking to their friends about, oh, did this really happen? And yeah, all of that kind of stuff.
Do you remember though, when this happened when they loaded the first tape? Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
This is a game that I'm familiar with, mostly because when I see like hardware reviewers test out the latest CPUs and GPUs, this is one of the games that features. So right. In my mind, this is a demanding game that requires lots of hardware, but I imagine you've played this on the Steam Deck again.
Yeah.
So how's that experience been, given that you've explained it's a bigger game and it's a newer game? How did the experience come? I mean, you finished it, so it must have been playable.
Yeah, I mean, it's been absolutely fine. There was, in this one, there were a couple of crashes, which I didn't really have in the first game. But in terms of overall performance, I mean, I imagine it's running at 30 frames a second, 720p, but it looks brilliant. There's no, like, real sort of juddering or anything like that. It's kind of put together quite well in that there are loading screens, but they're not, it doesn't go to black and say loading. It's like you've got to slowly push your way through a door to get to the next room. And so it sort of hides it all in between. Oh yeah, you've got to crawl through a small space, something like that. So you know, you have sort of reasonable sized but not absolutely enormous areas that you play in before you move on to the next one. So it's not trying to do too much in that, in terms of giving you a big open world that you can quickly run across, and it's not loaded the next cell yet or something like that.
Looking at the Steam page, the minimum specs are an i3 Ryzen 3 1300X CPU. Oh, wow, okay. And a GTX 1650 GPU, and recommended is a 3060 GPU. And the release date, I think, was April 2025, so just a little over a year ago, nearly 18 months ago.
Yeah. So I imagine it can look a lot better than it does on the Steam Deck, but as far as I'm concerned, it looks absolutely great. So the other thing that piqued my interest was, there's, aside from the playing through the main story, there is a roguelike mode. So this is slightly different, where you essentially get a series of encounters where you have to, essentially you're being attacked by different sorts of enemies. You've got to clear that encounter, and then you get some rewards, you can do some upgrades, and then you pick the next one, and you've got a sort of branching path through six encounters and then a boss fight. And the really cool thing about this is you can choose different characters who you don't get to play as in the main games. Like, all the supporting characters are then playable characters, and they all have their own abilities or their own starting stuff. So it's quite fun. And yeah, they have sort of slightly different behavior as you play as them. Some are bigger, some are smaller and faster. So it's quite nice to actually be able to play as all of these different characters rather than just the two main ones. It's also really, really difficult because, of course, as a roguelike, it's, permadeath. If you die in the main game, you basically go back to the last checkpoint, which is generally, a couple of minutes beforehand. And then you think, oh, I won't do that again. But with this, it's like, oh, I shouldn't have done that. And now I'm right back to the start. And the difficulty does ramp up quite a lot. So I've not managed to complete a run of this mode yet. I'm still working my way through it.
Is there a part three or is this the end of it?
I think they've said there will be a part three, but I don't know if it's actually been properly announced. And is it? I imagine that means it's in development. But yeah, one thing that's bothered me a bit is there was an announcement from Sony that they're going to stop doing PC releases of PlayStation games. And I don't know how that affects this. It's made by Naughty Dog, who I think are essentially a first-party Sony developer. They made Crash Bandicoot and other games like that. So I'm not sure if that means that Part 3 will come out on PC or not. I'll have to wait and see.